Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we're joined by Matt Craggs, who's head of operations at Flume. Welcome to the show, Matt. It's really good to have you join us today and take the time to do this.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of research into Flume, and I think that the standard practice that you provide, same-day delivery on a lot of occasions, must be the saviour of so many marriages around the country.
Yeah, I'd say, not coming from the floral industry before I joined Flume, what I can say, and joining just before Valentine's Day, all I can say is order patterns really highlight gender stereotypes around that area. It's very noticeable that in Mother's Day, where more of our customers are not male, let's say,
yeah,
the orders get placed much earlier.
Yeah, I can imagine. So I think, you know, to get the ball rolling a bit, could you give us a bit of insight into the business and what exactly Flume is before we delve into the main conversation?
Sure thing. So Flume started in 2016. Way before I joined, started by Lana, who's our CEO, really as a pure marketplace and it's for florists. And it was to solve the problem that was seen across the industry, particularly around order gatherers, where the end product that was delivered didn't match up with what you thought you were purchasing online. And with the sort of advent of smartphones and photo messaging, customers were much more aware that the bouquet that had been delivered wasn't exactly necessarily what had been ordered.
Yeah.
So what Flume set out to do was allow florists to sell their own product, to have their own style, to celebrate their independence rather than do the opposite, and give them the freedom to operate how they want and when they want. Selling what they want, which was novel at the time.
I was just going to say there's a lot to unpack there, but what strikes me immediately is that you focus on independent businesses, which is amazing. I mean, you could go down the different route where you just produce things on mass scale. What made you choose independent? For any major business, surely just doing things on mass is easier.
Yes, it would be easier.
Yeah.
But I think the benefits of working with a large number of small independents massively outweigh the negatives. In such a creative industry, I think by having a wide variety of basically content contributors to our platform in terms of designs, we're able to offer an extraordinarily broad range of product that really appeals to anything. Anyone, there's something for anyone there, and to an extent for any budget. I mean, on top of that, I think it gives us a really good ability to react quickly to scenarios and to changes in fashion and purchasing habits. Because I think if you look at the way you'd have to set these up as a production line process, your lead time is much longer in terms of shooting and preparing the processes and building out that approach, which is entailed in any disintermediated direct consumer brand in the floral industry. So it means that, you know, we can be offering new products based on variations in the season and very, very quickly, and meet a lot of different customer demands quickly, which was really useful during the during COVID. You know, we were able to bring a large range of products onto online that were slightly different. And so we launched our sort of Flume Market, which was not devoted to now, and actually we are not needed in terms of a revenue perspective, was a good way of diversifying the sort of portfolio of products we're offering, and was facilitated by the fact that our florists are all small independent operations that can change, like pretty much turn on a dime to bring sport back into it, and really helped us react to what's needed.
obviously, in this business, there's so many different moving parts. There's so much to think about. Obviously, flowers have a shelf life and offering same-day delivery. And, you know, as head of operations, I mean, how do we even logistically do that? It seems like such a mammoth kind of organizational task.
It is. We rely very heavily on our partners. We actually, and have done ever since the beginning, give them full control over how they fulfill their business. And our philosophy as a business is that we are supplemental to the way they work rather than necessarily overly prescriptive. So we want to basically bolt on the side of any florist business and add value, whether it be through our marketplace or through our product that we're really focusing on and have been for the last 12 months, Flumex, which is our SaaS product, which is designed to help florists run their whole business, not just their flume orders. And yeah, it's designed, we want to work in a way that's complementary to the way that florists already work rather than, and adds value using our technical expertise rather than tell experts in their field how to do their job. Yeah. So yeah, that's the whole philosophy about the way we work. And it creates some stressful times. It creates a lot of logistical problems, or not so necessarily logistical problems, but it can be resource heavy at times, particularly around peak periods where just keeping track of everything requires a certain number of phone calls. But I think the advantages to it far outweigh the disadvantages. I'll take a couple of days a year of a headache for the freedom and for the diversity of product we can offer on the platform as a result.
Absolutely. And we were mentioning a bit earlier about busy periods of the year, like Mother's Day and Valentine's Day and things like that. So in terms of the business, that's going to have a huge spike in popularity. So how do you like prepare for that?
We start preparing pretty much, well, we have three peaks in the year, really, for us, in terms of, and by peaks I'm meaning days or events where we have to significantly prepare from an operational perspective beyond our normal business as usual. So whilst we have busy months and quiet months where, you know, volumes might be up 20-30% or down 20-30%, these peaks when we're doing 20-30 times the volume we would normally do on a day, which obviously entails massive scale up of the team. So we start that planning process around June.
Wow.
For Valentine's Day next year.
We
have Valentine's Day, and then about 4 to 6 weeks later, 4 weeks this time, Mother's Day in the UK, and then we have a separate Mother's Day in the US, which is International Mother's Day, which is the second weekend in May. So those are our three kind of busy periods, and it's kind of like May 11th, May 12th, I get up and breathe and go and relax and have a holiday, and then and then get cracking again. And so we start that planning process in terms of talking with our wholesale partners to line up pre-sale supplies to our florists, looking at products, engaging external contractors are to discuss things like customer service and fleshing out those technical requirements that will feed into our product roadmap. Because we're really, I think, whilst there are some that can be filled by throwing resource at, one of the really valuable things of these peaks from a tech company perspective, which is very much how we view ourselves, is it puts our system under stress that it would not otherwise be put under for 2 or 3 years more growth in terms of the volume of orders and the volume of use. So you spot the things that break, and you also find the things that are really frustrating. And if they're frustrating us on a busy day, they're those little things that you can fix and make the florist's lives easier on a day-to-day basis. Yeah, so we start then, we've kind of locked in our final products now from a technical perspective, because I know that's obviously, well, some of the elements we're talking about, we'll look to do a sort of code lock basically 2 weeks out, just to avoid any untoward issues happening. because when you're doing that sort of volume, you can't afford to screw it up. From a reputation perspective, from a financial perspective, it's not something that's worth the risk. So we'll lock in now what work's going to be done. Then we'll go away and finalize and confirm our staffing levels and begin the recruitment process. So we do this for our various teams, looking after our florists on the day, looking after our customers. Obviously, the tech team will be focused on monitoring and making sure the systems are working and all that sort of stuff. But largely, we try to not involve them too much. You know, they're there to jump in if something breaks, but mostly they keep on with their work. We'll start locking in that training. Training will start early January with people. We work with a combination of our own in-house contractor teams that we have a pool of 10 or 15 we work with across the UK and the US, full-time people here and contractors through agencies.
There must be so much pressure on those dates of popularity. I mean, does a lot of your job come down to reactiveness? Like around that time, are you having to, react to changes just to ensure that everything's smooth, or do you plan well ahead?
If I'm having to react, I've done something wrong.
Yeah.
In the preparation from that perspective, because whilst there are elements where if something completely unpredictable happens, we have to react. But I think what is more important is, and I'm really well supported by my team, Beth Parsons, who's our head of customer success. She looks after our customer service and our florist community team. And we're identifying those issues months in advance, putting in step processes, backing that up with resources, be it comms resources, people, extra server capacity, whatever it is, and having that risk register that we start keeping and keep that rolling, so that actually when things happen, it's expected, we're moving on, and we will kind of take times where we'll be assertive. And I think the important thing we always have to remember is the customer has certain rights, and we operate within that. So when we know that we're maybe technically in breach, for whether it's a late delivery or something like that, we'll be proactively communicating and proactively looking from a reporting perspective and building our data reporting and KPIs, where we can spot where stuff's going wrong before it actually happens and intervene. Because let's take Valentine's, for example. If it's our late percentage is very, very low, but if someone's going to be late and you've ordered and you're going out for dinner, the last thing you want is someone showing up at 9 o'clock at night with bouquet. Yeah? And at that point, the purpose has almost failed already. You've already seen your partner.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
At that point, it feels, even if it was the best planned thing in the world, the perception and the feeling that's being conveyed is not quite as impactful as if it's coming there at 12 or 1 or we set 6 o'clock is the deadline. Because that's the idea. It's there while you're in your office. It's there before you go out for dinner. There's something planned. If we can tell someone about that it's probably not going to arrive on time by 4, you give them the chance to do something about it. There are plenty of local florists that are open and will still have stock. It's really just about giving them the right notice and communicating clearly, because I think the worst thing you can do is just go silent. Because that's when you get the phones exploding and everything. And I remember when I first joined, and it was a month before Valentine's Day, and we went in and we had a pretty bad Valentine's Day. It was pretty busy. When we look back at it, it was still successful, but it was incredibly stressful. And sort of putting those processes in place made it a relatively, I will not say stress-free, because that would be a lie, but that enabled us to really stay focused and stay on top of things. And that's something that we continue to do. So locking those plans in and moving forwards.
So the business was founded in 2016. I mean, how has it scaled since then? I mean, what was it like back in the day to what it's like now?
Well, so I joined start of 2019, so I've been here for almost 2 years. But we're doing about 8 times the volume we were when I joined from a B2C wow. perspective. More importantly, from a business perspective, we launched our software product in July of last year. We've grown that significantly, improved on that massively, including working with our wholesale partners to expand our wholesale shopping range, improve our functionality there to really deliver on that that ideal that we're going to bring everything into one place and make the forest lights as easy as possible. So yeah, from a scale perspective, if we looked at 2016 when we launched, say middle of 2016, and you're talking 10 or 20 orders a week, off the back of that you're maybe talking £1,000 GMV. Now we're talking, well, that's obviously hundreds of multiples on that. So it's quite significant growth. And from an operational perspective, it's like chalk and cheese, even when we joined. The level of maturity, the level of process documentation, the skill levels of everyone in the team, and their ability to understand our customer and deliver top level service is improved as you'd expect from 4 years of learning and 4 or 5 years of learning now, and learning the industry and learning our customers and who they are and how they work and how they like to communicate and spending a lot of time thinking about it.
Yeah, and I'm always interested in the scale of these businesses because that's such a quick rise in kind of growth and scale. If I say scale one more time, yeah, so was it quite a linear scale? I mean, did it happen quite naturally? Was everything set in place in the early stages for it to deal with that? Or was a lot of it...
I'd say there are a couple of big big points. There's a point where we went nationwide in the UK. So we started off as London only, which London is still our biggest market globally. Less so during lockdown. People tend to not be in their offices. Going to the whole of the UK, early 2018 when Flu moved into the US. I think that was a really brave move at the time, definitely against some people's advice. It's a complicated market to move into and can be very hard to do, but it was done well and done right, in that we maintain quality, maintain the level of service. And then actually, lockdown was fantastic for us. And it's something that we've sustained. I was saying we're a gifting-driven business on the B2C side, and we went from one or two people not being able to make the birthday party to everyone not being able to make the birthday party. So that was very beneficial. I think on the other side of things, we talk about the lockdown accelerating trends across every industry and every way of life around digitization and everything else. And I think the pressure that it put on the business and on the industry, whilst very hard and very tough for a lot of people, it also makes everyone have to think about how they run their businesses and the sustainability and the risk profile of your business. If you're focused on a particular sector exclusively, that you run more of a risk. So we saw a lot of florists having to diversify, and florists that could have very, very profitable businesses focusing on one particular industry sector, suddenly having to diversify and change. And we definitely benefited from that. And it, by the product being there and it being something that we were able to serve. But since then, we've sustained in a very good way, and I think done very well, particularly in the UK. Those are the kind of real kickers. We tend to see a big growth of year on year, as most of the part is that you see a big spike in Valentine's Day, and then it kind of catches up, and then it drops off. Then you see Mother's Day, and it drops off, and then it catches up again. In terms of our growth trajectory, July, August time, we get back up to operating at a level we were operating in February. And in February, when we thought we were really busy, and then we're going, oh, this is quiet. But that can only be achieved by the really good work of people that are putting into place different processes, different technical interventions, different like non-technical analog interventions that are designed to allow customers to serve themselves and allow them to be able to communicate with us in a much clearer manner and resolve any issues they have in much either themselves or by one or two touch processes.
Yeah. And during lockdown, independent businesses have really, really struggled. So it's amazing to see how you're supporting that, especially in like the florist industry where they would almost definitely just be closed. So it's amazing how you're supporting those businesses to stay alive, really, to put it bluntly.
I say I wouldn't say it's amazing for us. Like, we're just doing our job. This is what we are. What yeah. we are. That's a horrible stereotype statement. But no, I think it was our florists and our merchants that were that did the work and were there. They were on the front lines. They were running their businesses on skeleton staffs and churning out the same high quality day after day after day, and responding in the most industrious, like, positive manner. They were changing their supply chains, altering the way they worked, altering the products they sold based on day-to-day availability, and still being able to deliver that standard, which, you know, we are a platform. It's infrastructure. It's a way to connect a customer to the florist. And we are pointless if the florist isn't delivering a great product. You know, it's so I think that's really what they're doing, and that's something that I thought of before I joined Flume, before I was at Flume, Love Space, is that there are so many people that are doing fantastic work and are incredibly skilled at their industries that may not have the ability to market themselves or the ability to be utilized to their full effect. And that's where I think tech plays such a valuable role. And one of the reasons I like the business and wanted to join straight away is that it's facilitating these people to continue doing that fantastic work without having to force them to retrain. Or I can't remember. I wanted to say something pithy about that ballerina stuff that came out previously from the government. But it's the point is you're facilitating them to do their good work and allowing them to deliver it in a different way rather than trying to make them change what they do and change the skills that they've acquired over decades of work.
Exactly. It's amazing. And would you say ethical business practice is something that you have to take into consideration?
Absolutely. I think it's changed from 5, 10 years ago when everyone began, when I was coming into the workforce, to now. And the ethical business practice then was something that you offered us an upsell, or maybe, you know, you try and allow someone to carbon offset their purchase and to give yourself a little bit of a green halo. I think that's changed completely in consumers' attitudes towards you. You're now expected to be ethical. So you're not expected to offer the consumer the ability to be ethical. They're moving with their money and they're voting with their money. And if you're not ethical, operating in an ethical manner, you're running a significant business risk, right? Because cancel culture is real when it comes to businesses. And operating ethically can only be a positive thing for your business from a sales perspective. Yes, you might eke out 5% more margin if you do something differently, but in the long term, that's not worth it in my mind, because you're cutting off your nose to spite your face there.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm really interested in your career history, Matt, if we could delve into a little bit of that.
Thank you.
Could you give us a bit of background on that and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I started with a childhood dream of playing rugby, which I rapidly realised in my late teenage years was not particularly, okay. I wasn't quite gifted enough to be doing that. So obviously put it off to university once that disappeared. I started my career at Oliver Wyman, doing strategy consulting, mostly focused on finance, working the hours, getting on the planes, something that I gained a huge amount from in terms of structuring the way I think and communicate, the way to think about solving a problem and then go on to implement it. I got out of that, I think, probably too late for me. I wanted to do something, to implement stuff. I'll be honest, I got sick of working 100 hours a week to produce a slide deck that would go in front of someone and then nothing would happen. Or worse, doing something and then it'd be implemented wrong. The other side, and I think I stayed there longer than I should have. I'm not going to say I wouldn't do it again, because I think the people I worked with and the skills I acquired were tremendously beneficial. I think I stayed there too long to the point where it was starting to negatively affect my mental well-being, and that's something that I shouldn't have let happen in retrospect. And I saw the signs. I knew what it was doing to me in terms of stress, and I persisted because I didn't want to give up. I didn't want to give up on something until I'd had some more external validation of success there. And it took me to really hit a bad mental health period in my life where I didn't want to go to work, and I didn't even want to talk to my girlfriend, now wife, about it, or any of the stresses that was going under. I was trying to fit myself into a career that was not necessarily suited for me. So I left there, went to a brilliant company called LoveSpace, which are in the sort of storage and logistics area, who were fantastic for me. They're really great company. They're focused on, again, utilizing space and logistics capabilities of spare capacity across the industry to deliver a B2C product. I was there for 2 years. I learned an enormous amount. Talking of peak periods, I'm lucky now. I only have 3 days. Last place we had the famous student season, which was 4 to 6 weeks every summer and every September, where, you know, you basically didn't come home because of the amount of volume going out. But in terms of learning valuable lessons around how to run an operation at scale and how to scale up an operation quickly and scale your operational suppliers quickly, that was invaluable. In the end, I moved on because I wanted a new challenge. I met Lana, was really inspired about what they're trying to do here at Flume, what we're trying to do here at Flume, and that's why I joined. Why I'm still here is we're still having fantastic and interesting challenges to face every day, and I believe in the product we're delivering, and I believe in what we're trying to help our florists and the team we work with achieve.
Absolutely. I just want to touch upon the mental health side of things now, because obviously when people work in certain areas of business and technology, people suffer from burnout but without even realizing. I mean, did you realize it was happening?
I didn't. I think when I look back on it now, with the virtue of hindsight and the benefit of experience, is that I probably worked a year and a half too long in that area, in terms of when I think about now knowing what happened, what the warning signs were, I ignored them or thought they were just normal. You know, coming in, spending the entire weekend basically sleeping because you've worked so many hours during the week. I always joke that, you know, I left for a pay rise, but was materially worse off because I was awake enough to spend the money. I ignored that. I definitely wasn't honest with myself about the way I was processing criticism. And I think when I look back on it, completely valid feedback that I was getting from a professional perspective, I just did not have the energy capacity to implement. I think that's where it started. But yeah, I think it was, I didn't acknowledge it. And I tried to apply my kind of mindset when it came to my sporting career and to this of just like, I will keep on working and what I have to do is work harder and work more and put more of my life into it. And that was, you know, that was definitely the wrong thing to do. And it's something I now know. And it took me a couple of years to train myself out of some of the habits of that. I remember when I started at Love Space, I'd be in the office till 8 or 9 every night when everyone else went home at 6:30. And
God,
why am I doing this? It took me 2 or 3 years to get used to leaving the office at a normal time and making plans in the evening and doing things like that and re-engaging with university friends and people like that I just had not spoken to because I'd not allowed myself the time to do it for 2 or 3 years. And now I look back at it, I'm feeling much healthier, much better prepared to deal with those sort of things and process those sort of emotions.
What would you do differently if you could go back to that time?
I think I probably would have left the industry a bit earlier. I think a lot of my cohort left a year or so before me. I probably would have left then. As I said before, I would never have not joined. But yeah, I probably would have harder for work that interested me and work was in areas where with people I knew I could work with well, rather than accepting work in areas and working groups which had an environment that was very productive for them, but maybe a working approach that was not appropriate to the way I like to work and the way that was healthy for me to work.
I was just going to say, what do you think businesses can do to support that and support mental health?
It can start, and that's part of the reason why when the precursor to this I mentioned, I'd like to talk about this, is I think the start is from the top being open about everyone's problems with it. You may not have suffered from it, and you're very lucky. But I think definitely an impression I had, one of the things that stopped me getting help earlier or talking to people earlier, was the impression that people senior to me or people with more experience than me were just able to do it, and thinking that they just came and without having any of those issues. So subsequently talking to friends and ex-colleagues about that, you understand everyone went through these things. But if you go through life where the people that you're looking up to and that are in senior positions to you are not talking about it, you can quite easily convince yourself that it's just, you shouldn't talk about it. So I think first of all, being open about it. Second of all, being flexible about ways of working. I find an output orientated rather than a FaceTime culture is incredibly beneficial to that. For my teams, I don't care if they want to work midday till 8 or if they want to work, you know, traditional 9 till 6. If they're producing the output they need. I mean, obviously there are exceptions. If you're working on a customer service team and starting and need to be on the phone at 9 o'clock, starting at 12 is not necessarily appropriate. But I think that's one of the things is keeping flexible about that. So around some core hours which are needed, where there's FaceTime may be necessary, I think building that flexibility about how you want to work when you want to work is important. And giving people and allowing people, making it known that it's okay to take that time if you need it and take that mental health day. Because yeah. I think acknowledging that if you're awake, and that was something that was made very clear to me from the moment I joined here, was that was okay. You know, having a day when you're not at your best, when you're maybe you're suffering from something. You're feeling low, or you're having a day where you just don't have it. That is just as viable as if you're throwing up in a toilet.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
And in terms of your long-term health and happiness within the company, it's important that you feel supported to take that time off. And when I talk about it coming from the top, I just wanted to mention Steve Folwell, who was the CEO at Love Space when I was there, and he was the first person that openly talked to me about that and acknowledged that and kind of was able to have a conversation. Obviously, I won't disclose anything, but he was the first one that openly communicated from a very senior position, and a man and someone I greatly respected professionally and personally opened up and spoke about it in that way, in a relatable manner, and kind of said it's okay. I think that's incredibly valuable and doesn't get recognized enough.
Yeah, and it's interesting because those changes that you were mentioning there, that, you know, working flexible hours and etc., they're really small changes for businesses to make, but the impact is massive on individual mental health.
Yeah, I mean, we say our normal working hours are, I think it's 9 till 6, but anyone within the company is encouraged to, if they need to change or feel that a change is beneficial for them doing their job, to have that dialogue.
Yeah, and it's also having trust in the employees as well. I think trust is a huge part of it.
Yeah, I think that's the other side. If you feel trusted to do your job, you do a good job.
Exactly.
If you feel someone's trusting you, that matters. If you feel like you're being watched like a hawk and everything you're doing is being checked for every little bit, I personally don't find that productive. I find it just makes me, if I spend half the time justifying the work I'm doing the other half of the time, it just makes me irritated. Having that trust put in you and trusting your team around you. After all, you employed them for a reason.
I've worked under both sides of the coin. I've seen that first side where they're kind of monitoring you like a hawk, and also I've worked for a business where it's you're just trusted, and it comes right from the top, and it's from the top down, and the difference is astronomical in you know, well-being and, you know, just happiness of life. It's crazy. And that's, like we were mentioning, that's such a small change. Yeah, it's interesting. It's a really interesting topic. And, you know, we could literally talk about this for hours.
Yeah, you could talk about that for hours.
Yeah. But I think maybe, you know, if to wrap up, what can we expect from Flume in the months and years to come? What's on the horizon?
There's an enormous amount happening in the next 12 months. Some I'm allowed to talk about, some I'm not.
Okay.
obviously, I mean, we're very focused around, from the operations team, we're focused on Valentine's Day, focused on supporting our B2B growth. We're really excited with the work that's being done at the moment around our wholesale offering and making that process as easy and as stress-free as possible for our florists. And we're really looking forward to rolling out across the US as we build towards a Series A sometime next year. It's a really exciting time. I say there are some things I won't say because for strategic reasons, but I think we can expect us to continue to grow, continue to work with as many florists as possible, and really build out what this offering is and start scaling it in a really serious manner.
Yeah. Fantastic. I'm really looking forward to, you know, seeing what happens with Flume and following its journey over the next year or two. It's a brilliant business, and, you know, thanks so much for taking the time to chat to me today, Matt. It's been really insightful and it's been really interesting. Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform.